This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. At a campaign-style rally in Phoenix, Arizona on Tuesday night, Donald Trump denounced the protesters gathered outside, saying, quote, "They show up in the helmets and the black masks, and they've got clubs, they've got everything." He then added Antifa, referring to the anti-fascist groups that have mobilized, sometimes strategically using violence to oppose Nazis. In recent days on this program, we've discussed what the anti-fascist response in modern-day America could look like. Today, we'll discuss the effectiveness of nonviolent resistance, a tactic employed successfully by many movements throughout history. My guest is Antonia Juhas. She is a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist, and an award-winning writer who has contributed to Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, Ms., The Advocate, and more. She's the author of three books, Black Tide, The Tyranny of Oil, and The Bush Agenda. And she recently wrote an article in The Guardian entitled, American Politics Are Becoming Violent, But Peaceful Movements Have Power. Welcome to the program, Antonia.
Thanks for having me, Sonali. Great to be with you.
So I know that you, like so many of the rest of us, have been really thinking about what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, not necessarily because it was something brand new out of nowhere, but the scale of Charlottesville was higher than what we've seen from white supremacists. And of course, one innocent person got killed. And in this, in the wake of that violent clash and that flashpoint, what are some of the things that have been going through your mind as you watched not just the white supremacists, but the counter-protesters, those people who showed up to oppose them?
So much. I think most of us could probably spend weeks, if not years, talking about all of the forces that led up to Charlottesville and everything that's unfolded since. It's just going to be remembered, and it is a critically important juncture in American history, and hopefully in our understanding of the threads of power, of white supremacy, of violence, of authoritarianism, and how we respond and how people respond in the United States. And as you said, of course, white supremacy is nothing new in the United States. Racism, anti-Semitism, these are not new forces. But what was new was the size and scale of what took place in Charlottesville and the group's very clear intent of creating violence, of clearly mimicking Nazi rallies that have occurred in the past, so to visually make that statement, as well as in their words and their violence, and in their intent to commit violence. And that's why I call this, and of course many others do, a planned race riot, not a rally. And people also mobilized. And so I have been thinking, for years, as I think many of us have, about how you counters forces of violence, of authoritarianism, of racism, of hate, and what works, what strategies work best. And in the weight, and actually an article that I had been working on for many months now was an article looking at studies that I'd been analyzing on what works. And in the wake of Charlottesville and in the knowledge that more such events were being planned, it seemed really important just to get those thoughts out. And those are thoughts about the power, and what I would have called this article, the editors named it, is the overwhelming power of nonviolent resistance, and just how successful the power of nonviolence is in creating meaningful, fundamental, transformative change, including but not limited to regime change and unseating autocratic rulers in the face of extreme violence and death. And to me, the power and critical importance of that message was made all the more important in the wake of Charlottesville. And so that's why I wanted to make sure I got this piece out and into the into the dialogue, into the public discourse.
Now, what does nonviolent resistance look like? Let's talk about the way in which it actually plays out. And, you know, there are so many different modes of it. Even blocking a street, sitting down in the middle of the street with locked arms is nonviolent resistance, as is completely relaxing your entire body as a policeman is carrying you away, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the main bodies of work that I reference heavily throughout, and this is really an article that could have been written and probably should have been written by Professors Chenoweth and Stevens, who wrote a book in 2011, Why Civil Resistance Works, and then updated it in 2014 in a long journal article. And then I also reference a really wonderful lengthy interview in The Nation with Professor Erica Chenoweth talking about, and this just happened in February, the interview about how their findings translate into taking on the Trump regime. And their body of work, in addition to new studies that I've been looking at that are particularly looking at the role of violence as it's played out in the United States with the increased presence of U.S. military equipment used in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, then brought home to be used by police departments, and what effect that has on communities where that equipment's being used. So I pulled together that research. So the work of Chenoweth and Stevens, they compiled a first of its kind database of all 323 movements since 1900. From 1900 to 2006 is when that research ends, on movements that were trying to change autocratic regimes for self-determination, for unseating brutal regimes, and what worked and what didn't. And their studies were extremely conclusive that nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience were twice as likely as movements that used violence to succeed, and to succeed both in the short term and the long term. And long-term success meant, you know, if you change the government, did just another war take place, and then there was another government, and did another even more brutal government take over, or were the goals of the movement achieved, however those goals were defined, but primarily looking at movements to succeed in achieving peace and democracy. And they found that what worked was broad movements of people using nonviolence, but a diversity of tactics within nonviolence. So marches, civil disobedience, as you've said, blockades, strikes, boycotts, a diversity of tools that made it impossible for the ruling government to essentially continue on in its business and to attract more people. So what they found was the primary failure of violent movements is their homogeneity, that basically violent movements tend to be limited to young, able-bodied men, and that those men can exert a great amount of pain and violence, but they don't have the future-oriented planning, the ability to attract and build coalitions, the ability to work over the long haul to create transformative change and to attract more people, like women, like religious leaders, defectors from the government.
So, Antonia, is there a difference between defensive violence and offensive violence? And of course, it does, of course, depend on whether you are talking about the police kicking your head in or a non-police, just a citizen. Because I tried to imagine myself in Charlottesville, where the police simply stood back and the armed militants that were there from the right, I mean, some of them were heavily armed, wearing riot gear. I tried to put myself there and I thought, boy, if I was somebody on the other side, I would want at least a stick to protect myself if somebody came at me, to hit me. But I would have a hard time putting that stick to someone's head unprovoked. And some on the left did do some of those things because it's tempting to want to hit people who are waving a swastika, a symbol of genocidal violence.
Of course. And there is clearly a difference between defending oneself and the tactic, or defending others and the tactic of violence. So using violence as a tactic towards transformative social change is what the study is saying has not proven successful. And defending oneself or defending others is something else, certainly. And but, you know, within that context, and this is then moving to the other studies, one of the trends in looking at violence, and this is some of the studies that began looking at Ferguson and then other cities afterwards, where, as I was talking about, this heavily militarized and violent, unusually so, police presence appearing in cities using weapons from Iraq and Afghanistan. And what those studies and others are finding is, you know, really conclusively solidifying Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous quote that violence begets violence, that the presence of militarized equipment, of more violent tactics, elicits that in others. But even more so, even more than that, that violence tends to spread as a contagion. So your presence near violence motivates in you to respond with violence. But in the same way, essentially, the presence of nonviolence, the presence of de-escalation, de-escalates violence. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it like a contagion, like the way disease spreads, if you have a group of people that are infected with a contagion, let's say you have five people, you need, you know, depending on the disease, 25 or 125 people who have not been exposed to the disease to create a barrier so that it doesn't spread. And in a similar way, if you have a barrier of nonviolent people, it stops the spread of violence. And so, you know, let's say, I think many people have been involved in organizing or familiar with the idea of puppy piles. If someone's getting beaten up by the police or by a violent agitator, people pile on top of them to protect them. And so there's an ever increasing barrier of bodies, literally physical barrier of bodies, protecting the person that's being hurt. Now, that's not going to stop someone who's got a gun and wants to kill you, or a car and wants to run you over, or is, you know, beating up, intent on beating up whoever comes in their direction. And again, that's an issue of modes of defense versus modes of offense, modes of tactics and decisions on how you offensively engage with those who are intent on being violent or being violent. And I think in this we see, you know, Boston as this really sort of clear example of, you have, according to the police commissioner, 40,000 people who showed up to march and to show their presence against hate, which then completely dwarfed the, you know, depending on who was counting, 100 to a couple hundred white supremacists and white nationalists who were there. And that very well speaks to this idea of the, you know, nonviolent barrier, basically. These were people showing up, marching, and it completely eroded any sort of influence or power that this group had.
And actually, that's a really important point, because sheer numbers can overwhelm the violence, right? I mean, if you, in Charlottesville, there was a massive gathering of white supremacists, and even though there was a massive gathering of counter-protesters, they, you know, in spaces where the police just pulled back, they might have been evenly matched. One side might have overwhelmed the other. In Boston, there was an overwhelming number of counter-protesters. There was no need to deploy violence because just their sheer presence dwarfed the crazy supremacists. So that's part of the conversation as well. Antonia, isn't it also terribly easy for the narrative to get out of control when all the other side needs is one photograph, one image of somebody reacting violently to paint them equally, as Trump did, that there was violence on both sides, even when there was somebody being defensive on the left. Whereas the media narrative, such as we had during the civil rights movement, is often able to elicit much more sympathy when you see only one side using offensive tactics and violence. At the same time, of course, who wants to get beat up? I mean, you know, I don't want to get beat up, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, again, that is, you know, defending one's self. And that's a, you know, and that is a different question. So, you know, here's what I think. I think that we need to continue to focus on what the narrative is supposed to be. And I actually think the broader public has done that in the wake of Charlottesville. Trump has tried over and over again to make it a narrative about good protester versus bad protester.
And his base believes him, right? Because his base will believe anything he says. So you kind of have to...
Except for his base is shrinking, and his base has been shrinking. And there is a small percentage of people who are going to believe that. But that's not the broader narrative that's played out. I mean, I think it's very true that people have, by and large, remained extremely well-focused on the issue at hand, which is white supremacists. And a broader dialogue, I think, is taking place and does need to take place. And I think people are seeing this more and more about white supremacy in our everyday lives. White supremacy in the White House, white supremacists in the White House. That this is a dialogue that's bigger than one event, and certainly bigger than, you know, the tactics of a few people. And so I think we need to stay focused on that. And I actually think the broader public is. Trump's base, which is shrinking, he is losing their support for all sorts of reasons. And in the wake of Charlottesville, his poll numbers fell even more. And the good thing about the poll numbers right now, by the way, is that one of the biggest failures of polls before the election was that the only people who seemed to be polling the hardcore Trump voters was the Trump team. These people who were not self-identified voters because they hadn't voted, you know, either in years or ever, and then came out to vote for Trump. And that's why they weren't getting counted in the mainstream polls. People are now polling those people, those self-identified Trump supporters, and their numbers are shrinking. And they did shrink in the wake of Trump's response to Charlottesville. So they're also seeing it. However, that base includes, obviously, an emboldened body of white supremacists on the ground and white supremacists in the White House. And as I said in the article, they have been intent on violence. So one of the things that was revealed was since January, there's been a video that had been playing until Charlottesville on right-wing sites, including Fox Nation, which is affiliated obviously with Fox, a video of cars running through protesters that was played to the music of Ludacris's Move, and then a word I can't use on the air. Since January. So encouraging cars to be used as weapons of violence against demonstrators. And we know that Republicans in many states, starting in North Dakota as a response to Standing Rock, have been trying to get laws to make it legal to hit a protester with your car. And that this, the intent of creating violence, the intent of using the white supremacists and the violent right wing of the party is something that the Trump administration is doing and its followers are doing and becoming more emboldened to do, probably even more so as their numbers dwindle, because now they're in more of a mode of defense. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this piece, which is if they're going to get more violent, what do we do to try and respond and to change this regime? And what the studies show quite clearly is that a movement towards tactically choosing to embrace violence as an intent does not succeed in long-term transformative change, because it does not include coalition building, lots of different people, and doesn't look at and address and then build upon systemic problems to provide systemic answers so that you can envision what the future will be and build towards it and create it.
And also we should mention that the price that people pay for using violence as a tactic is different depending upon your gender and the color of your skin, your immigration status, etc. So those are definitely issues that play into it. Well, Antonia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll definitely post a link to your article so that people can read it themselves from our website later. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Antonia Yuhas. She is a leading energy analyst and author and an investigative journalist and an award-winning writer who has contributed to Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, Ms. The Advocate, and more. And she's the author of three books, Black Tide, The Tyranny of Oil, and The Bush Agenda. We've been discussing her article in The Guardian recently, which is entitled American Politics Are Becoming Violent, But Peaceful Movements Have Power. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.